Good afternoon. This is the Professor, Dr. Ron Daniels, President of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, and Distinguished Lecturer Emeritus at York College, Senior University of New York, welcoming you to this July 1st edition of Vantage Point here on 99.5 FM on the Pacifica Network here in New York, in collaboration with YCRadio.org. I've had some stressful days, so I had a stressful moment there. Just getting back from the Power Networking Conference, the awesome Power Networking Conference put together by George Frazier, Houston, Texas. Ooh, my goodness, must have been at least 1,000 people there. And but trying to get back with all this stormy weather, would these climate change deniers please stop? Took me 16 hours to get from Houston to New York. Oh, my God. Whew. So I am still stressed out. Anyway, very powerful show today. We hope, first and foremost, continue to want to urge people to become WBAI buddies. I do it every show. I'm not sure I'm being effective. I may need some training on how to do it better. All I know how to say is, folks, please become a sustaining member. Those of you out there who can afford it, of WBAI. For $10 a month, $120 a year, you can become a sustaining contributor. And you do it. It's very painless, actually. I'm a WBAI buddy. I don't ask people to go where I'm not prepared to go and where I can't afford to go. I give more than $10 a month. How much is not really your business, but it's more than that. And you can, too, if you can afford to, you know, $25, $50, $100, whatever. But you put it on your credit card, which makes it easy. It just happens every month. Or you can arrange for it to come out of a debit card or on your, well, I don't know about debit card, but you're going to make your checking account. You can make arrangements to do that, and it would be much appreciated by the management because it allows the management to know that there is a steady stream of income. And if we could get thousands upon thousands of people out there like you who are listening today who have it and could do it but have not done it yet, it would make life so much better for the management on your station at this citadel and fortress for resistance and transformation. And that's what WBAI is. As you witnessed most recently, the reparation stuff that went down and the hearings on the Poor People's Campaign and just so many good things happening here on WBAI and on the Pacifica Network, if you will. Secondly, I just want to, I'm always so impressed with the International African Arts Festival that's coming up. But particularly the 30th Annual Symposium on Culture and Community and Struggle, which is actually organized by NACO, the New York chapter of the National Association of Kawaito Organizations, Brother Segun Chewbacca and many, many others involved with it. And this Saturday, the 27th, actually I had hoped to be there, but we'll be out of town. If I get back, I'm still going to try to get by and catch some of it. It will be at PS 27287, that's 50 Navy Street in Brooklyn, and it starts at 9 o'clock a.m., goes to 5 o'clock p.m. Actually, the doors open with refreshments at 8:30 p.m., and they have a series of topics that are going to be covered. There will be a film, first and foremost, by on Wanimo Julius K. Nyeri, and a discussion by Melvin McRae and on him, and a discussion about Walter Rodney as well, and that's going to be great. Blacks and immigration will be a topic, as well as political prisoners, Africans in Palestine, arts and culture, and the politics of Jill Scott Heron. Wow, that's very impressive, and reflections on the East, and then. Maybe I can get back in town for this. The New Frontline, Reparations, Land, and Returning Citizens, a reparations topic. And it all goes down on this coming Saturday at beginning at 8:30 p.m. with the refreshments to 9 until 5 o'clock p.m. in the afternoon. P.S. 287 50 Navy Street, Brooklyn, New York. There is a fee, of course, which we don't discuss on the air. And the festival itself is also, they request a donation, and it's well worth it. So in order to get information, go to www.iaafestival.org. Go to www.iaafestival.org in order to get the information. And we'll make this announcement again towards the conclusion of the program. This is one that I always support. I think the International African Arts Festival is so great. It's like being at Frasier. One of the things about being at Frasier that we love everybody, but it is so good to just be immersed with black people. You know what I mean? And then Frasier does these positive black people. Black people who are doing something. Black people who are committed to black people. And when you go to the International African Arts Festival, everybody can come. It's free to everybody. And everybody, I mean, free, not free, you have to pay, but everybody's there. But the vast majority of people are just conscious black people in their African garb and music and vendors and food. And it's just such a wonderful event. And it has been sustained all of these many years, which means that our future is assured. Young people particularly, bring a young person to the symposium and bring a young person actually to the festival as well. I've brought my family there. They need to see this and witness it, because it will be encouraging and inspiring. Okay, got my announcements out of the way. Our two topics today that we're going to actually be discussing. One, which caught my attention because of the work I do as a Pan-Africanist, has to do with the issue of Africans and African-Americans in Africa. A new book. That's a constant discussion about our relationship to Africa. I do a lot of work in Haiti, and of course, there's a brother who did a book about that as well, African Americans and their relationship to Haiti, and it was quite a powerful book. So joining us shortly will be Professor Dr. Nimata A. Blyden. She's a professor at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. And then the 4th of July is coming up. And, of course, I've written many articles about this. And one of the most powerful speeches in the history of African people in this country is Frederick Douglass's speech on the 4th of July, in which he raises the question, what is your 4th of July to me? So at the bottom of the hour, Raymond Nat St. Turner. That's a hell of a name, right? Raymond Nat St. Turner will be joining us to talk about the alternative, the Frederick Douglass alternative 4th of July. And I sure enough support that. Well, getting right into the meat of our show for today, we're now delighted to welcome to our microphone, to Vantage Point, Dr. Nimata A. Blyden. Dr. Blyden, welcome to Vantage Point.
Thank you very much, Dr. Daniels.
And I just got finished. I've been traveling so much recently, but I just saw you somewhere. Where did I just see you? Was it some program?
At the reparations event at the AME Church.
That's right. The Metropolitan AME Church. But yes. I'd heard about you from a dear friend, Mel Foote, who is the president and CEO of Constituency for Africa. He is our representative in Washington, D.C., interfacing with the embassies and doing incredible work around Africa, and he is the one who brought your name up and suggested that you have to interview this sister. And when Mel Foote says interview and he gives me my instructions, I follow his orders. Great brother. Anyway, let's start with some background before we get into the meat of your book. And the obvious question is, are you related to the Blyden, the historical Blyden?
Yes, I am. He was my great-grandfather.
Oh, wow. I thought so. I was hoping so, because it's interesting, because one of the most remarkable books in that era was a book, as you well know, his whole piece on Search for a Place and his incredible journey throughout Africa and cataloging of so much of that and so forth that we as Pan-Africanists have come to know about and respect. But let's talk a little bit more about your background. In terms of your own work in Africa. Have you been deeply engaged? I would suspect so, but share that with our audience.
Yes. Well, my father, and so the great Gladden, of course, is my father's grandfather, so I'm descended from him through my father. And my father grew up in Sierra Leone. He himself was a Pan-Africanist and was very much involved in the nationalist movement in Sierra Leone to gain independence. He had a small party called the Sierra Leone Independence Movement. So I come from that tradition of activism and Pan-Africanism. And so I spent part of my youth in Sierra Leone and some of it here. My mother is African-American. So my personal story is directly connected to the book. I have a father from Africa, but those who read my book will see that I say I have a father from Africa, but the circle of it is that, of course, he's descendant from a man who was born in the Caribbean, and he also had ancestors who were enslaved people in the United States and ended up in Africa. And then I have a mother who's from Worcester, Massachusetts. So it's very much the story of the connection between African Americans as part of my personal history as well.
And it's also quite interesting, too, and I was thinking about this, when we look at, you know, the places that that Africans in America wanted to go, and certainly Liberia and Sierra Leone are, mm-hmm. are two of those places. In fact, in Liberia, a whole class of people emerged called the Americo-Liberians, actually.
Yes.
Interesting. And it was Garvey mm-hmm. who really, you know, it was the land that the Firestone Plantation now sits on, that Garvey was negotiating for in order for, you know, black people to do an economic base in Africa. So talk to us about the premise of your book, the narrative of your book. Why write a book entitled African Americans and Africa? It seems obvious, but just a term. Every day I run into people who talk about the disconnect, or some people are talking about the reconnect, that it is connected, mm-hmm. but this is not mm-hmm. an easy topic in some ways.
No, it's not. So the truth of it is, I for many years taught at the University of Texas in Dallas, and in 1996 I decided to do a class entitled African Americans and Africa Links in History. And this was because about maybe 6 months into that year, I lived in a small town called Richardson, and next to that was another small town called Plano. I woke up in the morning to a news report that had the headline that a black family living in Plano had their garage vandalized, and whoever had done it had written, "Go back to Africa," on the garage door. And so it got me thinking, where did these people think they were going to go in Africa, right? So this whole "go back to Africa" can have so many different meanings, right? The meanings that people like Blyden and Garvey had, but also the meaning that white Americans who wanted to get rid of black people in the United States had. And so I thought, well, why not do a class that looks at this connection between African Americans and Africa? And that's the genesis of the class that became this book, which I essentially wrote so I could teach my students. That's sort of the simple answer. But, of course, the much larger answer is this long-standing relationship that African Americans have had with the continent of Africa that didn't begin with the movie Black Panther, right? But that
yes.
started when the first African person was enslaved and brought to the United States. And so the long sweep of the book is looking at those who were brought from the continent of Africa as enslaved and their sort of tangible connection to the continent, and then everything in between, and it ends with a look at sort of the new African immigrant population coming here, what some people are calling the new African diaspora, and their tangible connection to the continent, and then the things that, you know, the ways in which African Americans have engaged in between, the Back to Africa movement that we've just talked about, but also, you know, what of Africa remained in black life and culture, how Africa prefigured in the imagination of African Americans. So it's not just sort of, you know, the tangible Africa, but also how African Americans conceived of Africa in their imagination, either as something that they were attracted to and wanted to grasp, or that they rejected, right? So I deal with all of those issues in the book, not just the sort of you know, this is my ancestry. But, you know, as I say when I quote Morgan Freeman, who says, you know, I'm not African, I'm American, right? Mm-hmm. And so there are those who say we came here, we were brought here, blood and sweat, tears, Frederick Douglass, this is our country. Mm-hmm. Africa is our past. And so I deal with all of those connections that African-Americans have had and not always an embrace.
Right. Let's deal with this imagination question, mm-hmm. because I'm now finished as a professor, retired recently, but one of the classes I enjoyed most mm-hmm. was a class I taught in Black social and political thought. And I used John Bracey's book, Black Nationalism in America. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, it's just fascinating, early on, you know, the free African population, you know, had this imagination. I mean, mm-hmm. Richard Allen didn't create the Black Methodist Episcopal Church or the colored mm-hmm. Episcopal initially. Mm-hmm. It was the African.
African. Mm-hmm.
And when you read through, there seems to be this tremendous knowledge even about Africa. And they obviously mm-hmm. were studying it. Tell mm-hmm. us about this imagination question mm-hmm. that you just talked mm-hmm. about.
So I actually have a chapter where I talk about the name, the naming, the different ways that we as Black people in this country have named ourselves and what we've called ourselves over the centuries. And I talk about this idea that in the 17th and the 18th century, people talked about themselves as African. It is the African Methodist Episcopal Church, the African Free Society, the African School in New York. We were using African to describe ourselves. And then we talk about the ways in which over the centuries that gets dropped. Africa becomes almost a negative. And we as Black people, whether in our desire to embrace our Americanness or be more accepted in this country, drop the Africa, right? Until Jesse Jackson comes back with it in 1989, mm-hmm. right? So we've had this push-pull relationship with Africa where for many, Africa becomes this imagined space. It's not one place. Of course, now we're doing DNA and people can say, you know, I come from this specific place in Africa. But for centuries, it was just Africa, right? A place that itself has been named by outsiders. And so what becomes Africa for many people is this sense of a place that they have ideas about, have imagined. And so we read over and over again stories of African Americans going to Africa for the first time, some being almost disappointed, right, because that's not what they were expecting, or being disappointed because they weren't welcomed or embraced with open arms, right? So this is what the nuances I try to get at as I talk about you know, how Africa has prefigured in the imagination rather than in sort of the real tangible ways of those who actually physically go there,
right?
So even those who have never been have a sense of Africa as being part of their history, their culture, their lives, even though they don't know what that is. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And the next piece I want to talk about, though, is this sort of the tangible connection and people who actually went and explored and came back to talk about it. Certainly, mm-hmm. Blyden was one of them. One of the most penetrating analyses, because very interestingly enough, at least what happened in Liberia is maybe indicative of what could have happened if people came with a. It was interesting that, you know, folks wanting to turn but having been Americanized in some ways and Europeanized, mm-hmm. what happened in Liberia was this class of people who virtually treated the indigenous people as if mm-hmm. in the same way that the pilgrims treated the Native Americans here, mm-hmm. I mean, with this mm-hmm. sort of a prism that they were uncivilized mm-hmm. and whatever. Mm-hmm. Biden did not mm-hmm. take that point of view. As you well know, this, you know, he had mm-hmm. a different perspective mm-hmm. on mm-hmm. the Muslims and the Christians, and he had a whole thing about civilization. But others mm-hmm. had a this jaundiced view that could have ended up in all kinds of disasters. But talk to us about one or two examples of people who early on, you know, went to Africa, maybe established relationships, built some things. Mm-hmm. Are there examples
right.
of that?
And, you know, and they go back recreating what they knew, right? So that's, I mean, because even Biden at 18, when he goes with that civilizing mission, he evolves, right, in the many years that he lived there. So that's the narrative, right, of divine providence. you know, it's the way that many African descended people who had been enslaved, you know, explain their enslavement in some ways, right? We were, you know, we were brought here for a purpose so that we could become civilized and Christian and go back and civilize our brethren. You know, we're looking at it now, and obviously that's problematic, but this was a, you know, this was a way of explaining their circumstance, their enslavement, their ideas. But many who went back, like Blyden, recognized that Africa probably had much more to give them than they had to give Africa, right?
Absolutely.
And so many of those stories, of course, get lost. We don't know what happened to many who went and settled because they integrated themselves with African communities. But then there were others who went and, you know, integrated themselves within within the community and wrote, like Blyden, and wrote about the positive aspects of that rather than I'm coming here to civilize you. What is it that you as an African can offer me who has lost? Right. Elements of my culture, who's lost elements of my religion, right? So it's a two-way street for many, not just that one-sided. We as your more enlightened brethren, and there was a lot of that. You know, it's a part of our history, perhaps that you know we don't like to talk about, but there was a lot of that. You know, where the enlightened ones that come and lift you up out of, you know, your barbarism,
right.
Which
right.
again comes from, you know, what they had encountered in the West,
right. And of course, at least in my lifetime, too, the depiction of Africa later on was not, you know, I mean, it was the Tarzan jungle gym,
mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
people being boiled in pots and all this kind of madness
mm-hmm.
and craziness.
Talk to us
about, you know, the, dare I say, the post-Jesse Jackson, and though he gets a lot of credit for it, there were many others. Malcolm
mm-hmm.
certainly was one who would use the term Afro-American, and he would say mm-hmm. African and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But it was
mm-hmm.
just Jesse's popularity, and he just
yeah.
said it at a press conference,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
boom, it got a popular kind of expression, and then all of a sudden people began to talk about it. So two other things I'd like
mm-hmm.
to just talk about quickly. How do you see sort of now the contemporary and by the way, this year is very interesting because there are many, many, many groups, including the Reverend Dennis Dillon here in New York,
mm-hmm.
who has what's called Door of Our Return to Africa initiative.
Yeah.
This is
mm-hmm.
And there are many, many, many of those going on. But so how
mm-hmm.
do you see how do you see it now, the connection and the perceptions in terms
mm-hmm.
of African-Americans and the relationship to Africa?
So one of the reasons, if you know, if I had really consciously thought about it, why I was interested in writing this book as well, was that a lot of the narrative surrounding the relationship always speaks to the tensions, right, and the frictions between the two groups, right? And what I was trying to do in this book is to show that that's not always been the relationship. The relationship is not always fraught with tension. Yes, there are tensions. You know, I've been teaching for many, many, many years, and every year I get an invitation by one or two Black student groups to say, can you come and moderate a conversation about the differences between African-Americans and Africans and Caribbean students. And, you know, when I was in college, we were having those kinds of discussions, and students are still having this kind of discussions. And what I wanted to say is, let me show you a history where that's not always been the relationship, that there have been relationships of alliances, of community. You know, when Africans first started coming to this country in the 19th century as students, and as immigrants, they came during Jim Crow and segregation. Who were their hosts? It was African Americans. You know, there's a quote by Kwame Nkrumah who talks about being in Harlem and having, you know, being welcomed by African Americans, right? So it's not just this tension-filled relationship, which seems to want to be the narrative, which I find problematic and I think is a distraction. That it's not all that. Yes, there are tensions. Yes, sometimes African immigrants come and they don't have an understanding of what African Americans have struggled to attain, and they take it for granted, right? And so it was as much a book for African immigrants as it was for African Americans to say, let me show you this history of this long engagement between African Americans and Africa and Africans. That you know that has existed, and it's not just one of difference and discord.
Right. It's interesting. I'm just thinking out loud. I hadn't asked to thought about this, and but there's this controversy, of course, about Senator Kamala Harris right now. You know, it's like who is she authentically a Black American, quote unquote? How Black is she? All of this kind of it's an interesting kind of discussion. But before we conclude, just a final comment on your discussion about. You say your book talks about really at the end, you know, you talk about the sort of the new African diaspora, the influx of continental Africans. I've just left Houston, Texas, and of course you were in Dallas, so you know this to be the case. There is now in excess of 50,000 Nigerians alone in Houston, Texas, a fair number in Dallas, and but all across the country. This is just a tremendous change in the nature of the African community. Talk to us about that.
Yes, huge. It's, I think the last statistic, I think, was 3.5 million African-born. I actually teach a class on African immigrants in the United States here at GW. So it's a huge population that's coming in. The flow is not necessarily going to stop, you know. And so what the argument I make is that it behooves that population, but as well as the African-American population, to recognize that, you know, in some ways in America, and I, you know, I won't give it away, but my last line, I think, speaks to this in the book, behooves us to recognize that the commonalities are much greater than the differences. Right. After all, when, you know, when a Black person's walking down the street and being harassed or being violence against that person is being perpetrated, generally the question is not asked, where were you born or where did you come from? And we're seeing that in the last couple of years that the attacks have been on Black people, regardless of where they've come from.
Right. Well, let's talk about how to get the book, and then you got an invitation coming because in New York we have a formation that Mel has come to. It's called a Pan-African Unity Dialogue. And indeed, if you go to our website, ibw21.org, you will see a presentation that has gone, I mean, just electrified people all. In fact, I just got another inquiry about it today, where our AU ambassador Erikana Chiribori-Kwa, spoke to the Pan-African Unity Dialogue. Okay. And the Pan-African Unity Dialogue is a formation of continental Africans, Caribbean Americans, Afro-Latinos, and African Americans. And it deals exactly with the discussion that you're having. You know, how do we forge relationships and not just simply assume because we're in the same spaces that we're going, that we are, you know, cooperating and whatnot. So I'm going to invite you to come to we have a meeting in November, and to bring your book, do a book signing and all that good stuff. Because you will be in a place, in a space. Dr. Julius Garvey is among those who, by the way, was one of the founding members of it. Sadiq Y, who is now the ambassador to Sierra Leone, is a charter member and so forth. So you're going to find this a very fascinating formation. But how do people get the book?
So the easiest place, of course, I always say Amazon, but they can get it through the press. Yale University Press is the publisher. And it can be ordered that way. I've had friends who've told me they've ordered it through Barnes & Noble. I've been targeting Black bookstores. I hope that Black bookstores carry it, and I understand that some Black bookstores are already carrying it. I couldn't name them, but I'm hoping that they do. But that Amazon is probably the simplest way. But for those, you know, who may feel that they want to get it elsewhere, the University Press, Yale University Press, is definitely first point of contact, because that's the publisher.
Okay, well, I have to call Melfoot and tell him that I have responded and I have been obedient to his command, because I have had an opportunity to interview Dr. Nyamata A. Blyton. We appreciate so much your insights. The book is absolutely not only fascinating, but I think critically important. I'm certainly going to get a copy. And we are going to invite you, as I said before, to the Pan-African Unity Dialogue in November. I'll get that out to you shortly so that you'll be able to come, make a presentation, and also do a book signing here in New York. And maybe there'll be others that you can do while you're here. So thank you so much for spending time with us this afternoon.
That would be great. Thank you very much, Dr. Daniels.
All right. Okay, we're going to take a break here. And by the way, I just wanted to and our breaks are to make sure that they're announcements of WBAI events that are critically important. Also want to take the occasion to say that we're preceded by Sojourner Truth by Margaret Prescott, who had an opportunity to interface with when we were doing the programming around reparations, both and last week she carried Professor Sir Hilary Beckel's speech at Metropolitan AME Church. And of course, following Vantage Point, there is the show Advocating for Justice with Arthur Schwartz. It will be coming up from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock here on WBAI. But we're going to take a break here and come back, and we'll be talking about the alternative 4th of July with Raymond and Nat Turner. But we take a break, a pause for the cause right now.
This year, let's go green. To save money in trees, the local station board election will use electronic ballots. Members in need of a paper ballot can leave a voicemail for the election supervisor at 510-854-9663 with their name, address, and telephone number. We are missing emails from many members. Please help by visiting elections.pacifica.org and filling out a ballot request form, including the email to which you would like us to send you your ballot. E-ballots will be issued to all members with a valid email on file. Members missing emails will be sent their voter ID and password hidden beneath a scratch-off on a postcard. Ballots go out to all eligible members August 15th, 2019. You are listening to 99.5 FM WBAI in New York, New York, and online at WBAI.org.
Okay, we're back, and you know, that was I'm really, really looking forward to purchasing a copy of the book by Dr. Nyamata A. Blyden, African Americans and Africa. Sounds like a fascinating book, and we want to certainly promote it. And we really need to, particularly now, one of the interesting things, just getting back from the Power Networking Conference. And, you know, this was very, in fact, the ambassador that I just referenced was the keynote, I mean, it was keynote speaker. They declared something called Fraser Nation. We'll have George Fraser on to talk about it. But it was awesome. And her presentation, welcoming and encouraging African Americans to return, I mean, it just had an incredibly powerful, powerful impact. So, again, we appreciate that interview. And having Dr. Nyamata A. Blyden, who is a professor at George Washington University and a descendant, her grandfather was Wilmot Blyden. And wow, that's quite impressive that lineage is still there. Well, what to your American slave is your 4th of July? I answer a day that reveals to him more than all other days in the year the gross injustice, cruelty to which he is constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham, your boasted liberty an unholy license, your national greatness swelling vanity, your sounds of rejoicing an empty and heartless, and your denunciations of tyrants brass-floated impudence, your shouts of liberation and equality hollow mockery. That was Frederick Douglass and his speech on the 4th of July at the Corinthian Hall in Rochester, New York. And I love that speech. And I don't celebrate the 4th of July. In fact, most black people don't really actually celebrate many of these holidays. But I also want to make it, you know, I want to keep pushing the point that until we are fully compensated, until we have changed the nature of who we are, relationship to this country, the 4th of July is not our holiday. And somebody else who apparently believes that and has acted on it is Raymond Nat Turner, who reached out to me recently, and I saw what he was talking about, and I said, I have to have him on just before the 4th of July. So, Raymond Nat Turner, welcome to Vantage Point.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Daniels. It's such an honor to be a part of your program. I'm a listener and whenever I can, and I appreciate all the work you've been doing.
Well, I appreciate the work that you're doing. And tell us a little bit about yourself, because I was just checking out a little bit, and it seems that you're a creative person. You use art and culture to make the point and so forth. So talk us a little bit about us, about Raymond Nat Turner. You sure got a powerful last name. That's a heavy weight to carry, Nat Turner.
Well, I'm a culture worker, and, you know, I've been influenced by some of the usual suspects. You know, when you go to the top of the Pantheon, there would be Paul Robeson and James Baldwin. And actually, I had the privilege of opening for James Baldwin as a youngster in L.A., you know, I was about 18 or 19, yeah, and I opened for Baldwin, which was, at that particular time, you know, when you're that age, sometimes you don't recognize the greatness that and only as you go forward and mature, you say, oh my God, you know, how stupid was I at that point, you know.
Right.
You know, they say youth is wasted on the young, and I have a longer story that I'll save for another time about that experience. And then, of course, Amir Baraka was a big influence on me as well. And my mom was a political activist in Los Angeles. She was responsible for one of the founders of the Martin Luther King Jr. General Hospital there and the Charles Drew Post Graduate Medical School, which was the first school, black medical school, west of the Mississippi. You know, and she also spearheaded the fight to bring public transportation to South Central Los Angeles. And a thing that's very interesting is that the youth center that she was in charge of became the nucleus for the Southern California chapter of the Black Panther Party.
Oh, wow. That's really
cool. Yeah.
You sure enough got you some Nat Turner in your veins anyhow, right? Sure enough for real. Well, talk to us about the alternative 4th of July. What's the genesis of it? And the background of it, just sort of share that with our audience.
Well, it's an interesting thing in that it's the sister event of a jazz poetry festival that I produced in the Bay Area, in the San Francisco Bay Area in 2007. We have a jazz poetry ensemble called Upsurge. Now it's Upsurge New York City. And so it had been my dream to produce a jazz poetry festival, and so we did it, and we did it on the filament of a shoestring budget, and we were helped by some of our friends with the ILWU, International Longshore Warehouse Workers, Local 10 out there, you know, the hell raises out there.
That's right.
And, and so we did that, and so one of the a band member said, oh, man, this is such a great gig. And she said, we need to do something else. And I said, sure. You know, you find it and you talk to me. And I was really just trying to blow her off and because I figured she wouldn't be able to think of anything and she would go away. Or she would come with something that I could, quote, veto. And she came, she sent me Douglass's speech, What is the 4th of July to the Slave or to the Negro? I've seen it titled different ways. And, I had heard about the speech and maybe I had seen an excerpt, but when I looked at it, you know, closely, I said, oh, we have to do something. And so that is the genesis of the event.
And so tell us about the particulars of it, the where, when, and what are we looking at?
Well, it's Even going back to when we did the first one, you know, she had proposed, why don't we do it on the 4th of July? I said, no, let's do it on the 3rd of July. And you know, Douglas gave the speech on the 5th of July. So we thought, you know, what my thinking was is if we did it on the 3rd, people would have the next day to recover from hanging out with us all night. And,
right,
you know,
right.
And you mentioned something, Dr. Daniels, that is actually near and dear to me, which I found out as a result of doing this, is that in my family's history, the 4th of July was not celebrated. People were forbidden to celebrate it. They actually had to be working on that day, you know, doing something productive. And so when we did the first one, we came back the next day to, we did it at the Oakland Public Conservatory of Music. And so on the following day, we came back, we had leftover food, we had music from celebration. And so we painted and reorganized and moved furniture around there. And we had just a grand time of a work day, and it left something tangible in the community, an improvement in the community. And so this year, it's on Wednesday, the 3rd of July, and we're going to be at the National Writers Union, which is at 256 West 38th Street, and that's between 7th and 8th Avenues, and it's on the 12th floor.
Okay, and what can people expect? Give us a sense of what it's like to have this this upsurge event.
Well, what we always like to do is we have readers. When we did it out in Oakland, we had two actors who had been worked together a number of years doing Jeff Stetson's play, The Meeting, so they were very familiar with one another. So, but here we've done it a little bit differently. Like last year, we had readers that read excerpts from Douglas's speech. Some of the people you well know, Ralph Pointer, Heidi Boghossian from Law and Disorder, and Margaret Kimberly from Black Agenda Report. And so we had, you know, some activists, organizers reading, and then we had some poets contributing solidarity poems, and then our band Upsurge NYC did a set to close it out, and we had refreshments, and actually we had a large carrot cake, compliments of Ralph Pointer, because it was Frederick Douglass's 200th birthday.
Wow!
Yeah, so we had a grand time, and we actually didn't get out of here until about 2 or something like that.
Oh, wow! You say so it was hard to work the next day. All right, so give us the particulars again. It will be the where. Give it to us again, and the time, and everything, and then how people can be in touch with you either by email, website, or whatever.
Okay. Yeah, again, it's Wednesday, the 3rd of July at 7 p.m. at the National Writers Union, which is at 256 West 38th Street, and it's between 7th and 8th Avenues, and it's on the 12th floor, and it starts at 7 p.m., and it goes until we have to go home. I think that's pretty much.
So, and how come, is there a website that people can go to? Is there a phone number that people can get further
if
information?
If people need to contact me, they can contact me at upsurgejazz@gmail.com. Again, that's upsurgejazz@gmail.com. And by phone, 646-683-1446. But the email is the better option.
All right, 646-683-1446. So that people can get together and have an alternative
Fourth of July.
I like it. I love it. I really do think that these are the kind of things that we need to focus on. And I think one of the best ways to get at it is through art and it's through culture.
Yes,
and,
I totally agree with you.
And
it's kind of a route to people's hearts, you know, and I think that's so important, you know, because at the end of the day, when you hear Lady Day or Coltrane, you know, it moves you in a certain kind of way.
Right.
You know, the eloquence of Dr. King and Malcolm and so forth, that definitely moves you and excites you and incites you. But when you hear, you know, you hear Lady Day or you hear Train, it does a different kind of thing to you, but it takes you on the journey. You're heading on the same road, but you know, you're traveling on different kinds of equipment, let's say.
Right. All right. Okay. Well, Raymond Nat Turner, thank you so much for spending his time with us this afternoon, and we know that the program on July 3rd will be a big success. That is the alternative 4th of July. Thanks much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me, and keep up your work.
Well, thank you. We're certainly going to try.
Okay.
We have a few minutes left. I don't know whether we should invite any callers or not, since we don't have much time left, about 8 minutes. I actually wanted to get into this discussion on Kamala Harris. Maybe I can do that next week. I'll figure it out in terms of how we structure the program. Because I would like to get some opinions about whether or not Kamala Harris is black enough. Just based on what has been discussed in the last, the last 48 hours. I'm just interested in what people's take on this issue of her lineage. And is she really African-American? Is she really black? I would be interested in just sampling that with the audience. But since we only have just a limited amount of time, I don't think I'm going to try that. What I think I would prefer to do is to re-stress that you have the opportunity to go to this alternative 4th of July. It's going to be a big musical, cultural extravaganza with poetry, with readers and music and all of that good stuff, dealing with, you know, how not to get caught up in the false patriotism, the fake patriotism of the 4th of July. And indeed, Frederick Douglass, concluding his another excerpt, says, "Your prayers and your hymns and your sermons, your thanksgivings, with all of your religious parade and solemnity, are to him," meaning the enslaved African, "mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy, a thin veil to cover up crimes which disgrace a nation of savages." This is not a nation. There is not a nation on the earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of the United States at this hour. Shades of Martin Luther King saying, "I could not condemn the violence that I was seeing occurring," paraphrasing him, "in the urban communities, the urban ghettos of these United States of America, until I first condemned the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today," paraphrasing him again, and he said, "my own government." And so what we see today is an ongoing need, really, to continue, a lucha continua. You know, I really resist this whole notion of wrapping us in the red, white, and blue. Holidays should be family days, days of reflection on the history of Africans in this country. And if you don't want to get too political, just bring the family together and just embrace each other, hug each other, love each other, and testify to the fact that we've been on this long sojourn in this country. Vicious, bloody, yet triumphant. We are a triumphant people. reflect upon others who have been oppressed within these shores. Native Americans first, the original sin, the brutal, genocidal dispossession of Native people. We should be thinking about that, not just during Thanksgiving, but always. It should always be a part of our consciousness. Indeed, as we start talking about reparations, I'm going to be encouraging National African American Reparations Commission to incorporate into our narrative an understanding or an admonition that we continue to uphold Native Americans and that this country continue to be held accountable for the original sin, the dispossession of Native people in this country. They have yet to be fully repaired. And so we are looking for reparations. We as African Americans, we are going to get them someday. Deep in my heart, I do believe that we will achieve reparations in the not too distant future if we only believe ourselves as people of African descent. And so we're going to be pushing forward with that. Let me just say that, again, I want to continue to urge people to go to the website, IBW21.org, IBW21.org, and to read the 10-point program. Now, let me just say, and people are doing it, and we appreciate that. People are signing up. There's an increasing number of people who are looking at the 10-point program and offering comments. Now, I am not going to respond to every letter, every comment, and so forth. I really don't have the capacity to do that. However, send them anyway. I'll tell you why. Because we're compiling them. We're compiling your comments and your insights and your observations, your criticism. We are compiling them for the National African American Reparations Commission to review. So keep them coming. But don't expect, sort of like a debate, a dialogue, a social media, whatever. That ain't happening because we ain't got time for that. I don't have time for that. But what we do have time for is we're going to catalog it. And we're going to be, as we meet, we're going to be reviewing it. And there'll be some that we'll post, actually on the IBW website, some ideas that will be put out. So, again, that Reparations Resource Center on the IBW website is the most extensive online Reparations Resource Center anywhere in the world. Trust me, you can spend days on the IBW website learning so much about reparations. And we'll talk about more about this. I'm actually looking at the invitation now. I'm going to be going to Antigua to speak to be a part of the Emancipation Day activities there, particularly to speak to the question of the National African American Reparations Commission, H.R. 40, the 10-point program, and our synergy and relationship with the CARICOM Reparations Commission. I would be honored to be able to do that. Now, let me also once again suggest that you go to wherever, Amazon or just Google this book, African Americans and Africa, a new book by Dr. Niamata A. Blyden, the granddaughter of Wilmot Blyden. An incredible interview we did with her, and we hope that you'll find the book useful. Again, we're going to invite her to be a part of a Pan-African Unity Dialogue meeting in November. And last but certainly not least, on this coming Saturday, the glorious, well, the celebration begins before then, but the symposium, the 30th annual symposium by NACO on culture, community, and struggle will be taking place July 6th. That's PS 287, 50 Navy Street, Brooklyn, New York. And they have a range of topics from immigration, looking at Julius K. Nyerere and Walter Rodney. That's powerful black immigration, Africans in Palestine, political prisoners, the new front lines of reparations and returning citizens. All these topics will be covered, and you can go to www.iaafestival.org, www.iaafestival.org, in order to get all the information you need on that. And don't forget, subscribe and become a WBAI buddy. Coming up next here on WBAI 99.5, FM is Advocating for Justice with Arthur Swartz, coming up right now here, or at least in a few minutes here on WBAI. This is the Professor Dr. Ron Daniels with Vantage Point signing off, saying we'll see you again next week here on this station.